It seems there are always interesting stories coming out of Cuba. Just look at the headlines for the last few months about American diplomats and visitors displaying some unusual medical conditions and the Cuban government denying having anything to do with that. The real Cuba and real events mingle with fictional characters in a new book by Ashland author Robert Arellano called Havana Libre. Robert Arellano is a tough guy to categorize. He writes, sure. He's written six novels before this one and received praise and awards for them. He also teaches at Southern Oregon University, but he's on sabbatical now. And he's a musician and creator of art in places besides the written page. So, Robert Arellano, always good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Great to see you again.
It is clear from reading Havana Libre, I guess I should be a little more ethnic and call it Habana Libre.
Muy bien. You said it perfect.
That you are intimately familiar with Cuba. Tell us about your family history there.
Yeah, well, my family left Cuba, my parents and my three brothers and sisters, a fourth on the way, in November of 1960. I actually have my dad's passport and my mom's passport. It was stamped November 18th. And I was born in the States and brought up in the States, but I really surprised everyone in 1992, 25 years ago, when I said I'm going to be the first one in the family to go back. And for me, it was going back, because having grown up between the New York suburbs, where there was a Cuban population, and Miami, I never felt quite at home in the Cuban-American communities that I got to know in the States. Yet the moment I touched ground in Havana in summer of 1992, I felt like I'd come home.
So what is a gusano? I noticed that in some of your writing.
Yes, gusano literally means worm, and it's a term that was used as a pejorative by Fidel Castro to describe those Cubans who left in the late 50s, early 60s, the worms. But then it also became self-reappropriated by those Cubans as a sort of a term of pride. Well, if Fidel's going to call us gusanos, then somos gusanos, and we're proud of it.
So take on the name that's been used as an epithet.
Yep.
Yes, it's a very popular move, I notice, of late. And you were talking about your background and the places you felt at home and not. And I gathered not a lot of Cuban families in Summit, New Jersey, where you spent a lot of your childhood.
One of exactly two Cuban families in a town of 30,000. Me and Tony Garcia, still a friend.
Good.
And we had each other. And that was good. That was good. We had to drive about a half an hour to go to the best Cuban bakery in northern New Jersey, which coincidentally I got to know a couple of years ago. Nicole Aleman, the director of marketing at SOU, who married a Cuban, and that family owns the best Cuban bakery in northern New Jersey. So there is a connection here, and if you want a really good pasteito de guayaba, I'm sure he can hook you up.
What's in there?
Oh, guava, sort of a paste made out of the guava fruit and cream cheese, and it's that finely layered sort of, almost like Greek pastry, but a very Cuban thing. And then throw more sugar on top, too, just because there wasn't enough in the filling.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah.
All right, so talk. You visited Cuba yourself for the first time in 1992, or came home to Cuba, as you put it, in 1992. In Havana Libre, in the book, there's a body cavity search in Cuban customs on the second page. Has that ever happened to you?
I got several pat downs, but never a body cavity search. I learned about the body cavity search through reading a book on the actual historical events that provide the backdrop for Havana Libre, which is bombings in the summer of 1997. That were organized and funded by Cuban exiles in Miami. The exiled Cuban community in Miami over the last five decades has been variously violent and extremist with regard to their opposition of the Castro revolution. And in 97, I was there. Several hotels and restaurants were bombed. Mostly injuries, but one notable death, Fabio De Selma, an Italian descendant Canadian citizen, 32 years old, was killed by a bombing at the Copacabana Hotel in July of 97. So that cavity search, it takes place in a nonfiction book called The Last Soldiers of the Cold War about the Cuban Five, and it's an extraordinary scene. They were that close to catching the bomber who killed Fabio De Selma, but they didn't look in his boots. They did not look in the toes of his boots.
Wow. Oh, that close. So they checked everything else,
uh-huh.
Just not that. Whew. So the idea of taking a real-world event, a real-world criminal event, catastrophe, terrorism, whatever you want to call it, and putting it into your book, was there any hesitation about that, or was it really the propellant?
No, propellant is a good way to put it. Maybe accelerant, because the original seed for both Havana Libre and its predecessor, Havana Lunar, which published 6 years ago, was a finalist that year for the the Edgar Allan Poe Award that's given out every year by the Mystery Writers of America, something I'm very proud of. And I hope to go back sometime with Havana Libre and get that opportunity to move beyond finalist to the actual award recipient. But this book, as well as its predecessor, had to do with a character who came to me in that first trip in 92, which was, what would my life have been like had my parents not left? And Dr. Manolo Rodriguez, my family always told me I probably would have been a doctor, is an idealist, but also struggling in the special period. Fidel Castro's euphemism for the economic hardships that Cuba suffered after the end of Soviet subsidies with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Comic-Con sort of economic bloc, all that stuff, came into making this character. In 92, the story was somewhat of a personal story where he gets a little too involved with a patient who's at risk. Now, 5 years later, I said, that summer of 97, I was there. I remember the tension on the street. That would make a great backdrop for a noir, another Cuban noir novel. And with that, just adding Manolo and another character, a Miami Cuban who's based on actual Cubans, kind of a composite character who funds the bombings. That's how I got the story behind Havana Libre.
I am still struck by the use of the term the special period for the period after the Soviet support ended in Cuba, because you have an avowed enemy of capitalism, Fidel Castro, essentially using a marketing term to describe a bad period in their history.
He was such a master marketer, a master of euphemism. It's remarkable when you hear his speeches, and the Cubans are aware of this irony, that he just got away with murder, as it were, in his vocabulary.
I have to ask about the sighting of Fidel Castro, but that'll have to wait until after a break. We're talking to Robert Arellano, the author of Havana Libre, which actually the publication date is not for 5 days yet. Still ahead of us. It'll be tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we resume our conversation here in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest at the moment is Robert Arellano, who is an on-sabbatical professor from Southern Oregon University who teaches creative writing and does a fair amount of it himself. His seventh novel is about to be released. It's called Havana Libre. It's about a reluctant spy, a doctor, actually a medical doctor, in Cuba, who ends up doing some work he didn't actually sign up for in the first place. We'll unfold the story bits just a bit. Bobby Arellano will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. He's here now. You can join the conversation about the Cuba portrayed in Havana Libre or the Cuba portrayed in the real world, the real Cuba that exists. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Fidel Castro and his genius at euphemism and twisting things around. He was actually a good marketer for a guy who hated capitalism. And I read your essay, The Real Fidel. You actually saw Castro briefly?
Yes, and that was actually my second trip in 92. I went back 6 months after my first in the summer, and it was around this time of year. I was walking with some friends across a busy avenue that everyone knows about in Miramar, where Castro's motorcade would frequently go from one of his houses to the palacio that he had his offices in. And there was some strange police activity happening on the corners. They were starting to shut down traffic. They weren't even letting people cross, pedestrians. And my friend said to me at the time, would you like to see Fidel? I said, yes. He said, just wait 5 or 10 minutes. He should be by any minute now. The streets were completely cleared, and you see the motorcycles coming. And behind those, about 6 black Mercedes, armored Mercedes, they scream by so fast. And in the very first one, the window was rolled down. And there in the passenger seat is Fidel with the beard and everything and the green, olive green garb. But in the third Mercedes as well, now in the back seat, there's Fidel. And I realized he always travels with doubles. There were probably 3 or 4 Fidels in that entourage before they even passed. So which one was the real Fidel? I'm not sure, but I'm convinced I saw one of them.
In the level of detail that comes out of the real world of Castro's Cuba, I mean, there's just so much you could have packed into this or any novel. And I wonder how much you had to go, oh, that's interesting, but I can't use it. It's going to make the book too long, that kind of stuff. I mean, how much whittling did you have to do of places and real people and events in Cuba to be able to make a good, fast-moving story in Havana Libre?
Yeah, Havana Libre, for me, even though it's only about 275 pages, it's a dense book in that there are – it's like condensed soup. There are so many stories that I could have gone on for a whole chapter about that I only take up a paragraph or two. I think that that there's an opportunity for people to go back and read more. For instance, that book on the last soldiers of the Cold War is rife with opportunities. I teach a novel writing class in the winter here at SOU. I'll be back from sabbatical in a month's time. And I might just let some of my students read some nonfiction and say, hey, try to take this and turn something into fiction with it, because it's almost too good. You can't make it up.
So in fact, Havana Libre is a real place, is that right?
It's a hotel. It's the most famous hotel, where Fidel took up an entire floor in January of 59 with the triumph of the revolution for his headquarters. And it used to be the Havana Hilton. He renamed it. I figured the Hilton family was kind of ticked about that, because it had only been open a couple of years before it got nationalized, the fancy word for commandeered and stolen by the government. But you can go there to this day. I was there 2 weeks ago. I took a selfie in front of the Havana Libre Hotel with my new book. And in fact, it's a place that becomes, as people will learn, no spoilers here, but a sort of a seat of some of the danger at the heart of the peril, at the heart of the noir. Havana Libre.
As the story unfolds, I mean, a fair amount of Spanish shows up in here. I mean, it's not necessary to know Spanish, but it certainly helps, I find. And it doesn't seem like the Spanish taught in American public schools. Can you compare Cuban Spanish with the kind of Spanish you learn?
You're absolutely right.
Huegas Altanis, yeah. And all that sort of thing.
In fact, the stuff that I left in Spanish, and a certain amount of Spanglish too, my good friend and coworker at SOU, Ed Battistella, asked me about it and put a good term on it that I'm learning about, called code switching, that happens not just in Spanish-English, but in a lot of different languages or vernaculars. I left in the Spanish that I did deliberately because it was such a Cuban and Cuban-American Spanish, since a good part of the book also takes place in Miami and we switch between sides of the Cuban communities. I wanted to leave the Spanish in, and I found that readers are definitely able to make out what the meaning is, even of words that are unfamiliar by the context, but that when I get to give a reading like I will tonight at Bloomsbury, it allows me to help people understand the musicality of Cuban Spanish when I get to read it aloud.
Well, it helps understand, too, that at the University of New Mexico, Taos, you created a dual language program in literacy and cultural studies.
Yes, and dual language for me is such an exciting and interesting way of teaching. It's not bilingual. It doesn't mean you've got to know both languages. It means that the people in the classroom may be native English speakers, native Spanish speakers, or some combination, but that the instruction will take place both in English and in Spanish. Que todas las clases se resuelven en español y en inglés. And you begin to switch back and forth, and it takes a little bit of practice. Hay que practicar un poco, but it works after a while. And even the people receiving the instruction, I think, get something out of it that's greater than the sum of the parts.
So as we get further into the book, Havana Libre, how big and sophisticated is Cuba's spy operation that Dr. Manolo Rodriguez gets involved in?
Yeah, the Department of State Security is infamous, and yet I don't think it has some of the same horror attached as, say, some of the Russian or German Secret Service organizations of the Cold War, partly because Cuba, being a nation that mostly has removed firearms from public access, that is, only government and military, that is, and police have access to firearms, means that controlling the population on this island nation doesn't require the same amount of violence. However, the surveillance and the way that the Department of State Security also uses neighborhood watchdog organizations known as the CDR, Comité de Defensa de la Revolución, the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, those are pervasive throughout the island. I had a sense from the 90s up until my last trip just this month about the concern people have for being overheard.
Bobby Arellano is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest novel is called Havana Libre, with the publication date of December 5th. He'll be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. He's here now on the Jefferson Exchange. You can talk about this book or his other many interesting projects. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about Mano Rodriguez himself, Manolo Rodriguez. He is a pediatrician, but this is not a really high-paying gig in Cuba, at least in the Cuba portrayed here, as it is in America.
And this is something that's sort of famous, even apocryphal, but with some truth to it with regard to Cuba since the special period in the early 90s, the doctor who has to moonlight as a cab driver. Because as a doctor, you may get a salary of 300 to 400 pesos a month, but that translates to about $15 U.S. dollars. And access to dollars to this day, and really since I began traveling to Cuba in the early 90s, is the only way you can get certain things. The rice and beans and the ration of a certain amount of nutrition, and also your housing is subsidized by the government to the point where pesos will pay for that. But if you want to get access to anything, entertainment, technology, or beyond the usual minimum basic requirements for your diet, it requires access to dollars. So that's part of Mano's dilemma, is that he's a impoverished doctor who's working awfully hard in a developing country known for its medical, universal medical care, but that doesn't reward doctors as well as it rewards a waiter or a bus person at a restaurant.
Wow. And in fact, Dr. Rodriguez had a bit of a tortured childhood too, I guess.
Yeah, there's a story behind his father leaving when he was a little boy that you get into a little deeper in Havana Libre, and wanting to bring the family after him to Florida, but getting the runaround and red tape from the National Medical Service in Cuba without releasing his records to the Florida board, he wasn't able to practice medicine. And so the family's torn apart. The mother develops cancer and also becomes clinically depressed. And Mano has to fend for himself from the time he's a young boy.
And so he really doesn't know his father, but his father does become a major character in the story in Havana Libre.
Yes, it's the father he never met, literally, who left when he was still in utero and was planning on bringing the family. And there are stories like this of the Cuban community, not just in the early 60s, like when my parents left, but into the late 60s and into the 70s, of leaving and not being able to reconnect for decades.
Which leads me back to the real world and your experience of it. I can imagine growing up as a child of a Cuban family in New Jersey and in Miami. I mean, you had a real sense from stories of what Cuba was like, but how much did that build you up for what you got when you got off the plane in Havana the first time in 92?
Sure. I remember on the plane being concerned that I was going to be followed, that there was going to be hostility from common Cubans towards me. Really, from that very first cab drive from the airport, when the driver asked me where I was from, and I asked him, to guess. It took him a while. But when he found out I was from the States, he said, "Mira, tengo un mensaje para los Americanos. I have a message for the Americans. That thing between the government is a government thing, the embargo, what they call the blockade. But Cubans love Americans. We love your food, your culture, your music, and we can't wait until the day that this embargo is over and we have restored relations, and we're going to have a great party, a tremenda pachanga." And that message, with a few very minor exceptions of when I've been to a government or a social, a communist party function where there's been a presentation, has been the attitude towards from Cubans towards Americans since I started visiting 25 years ago.
So you've been to Cuba recently, several times then since the diplomatic relations were restored?
Yeah, it was on January 5th of this year that an airline made the first trip from the West Coast direct to Havana in more than 50 years. And I got online that day and I bought my fare from LAX for $139
Wow.
each way. And that's the same fare I went back on twice this year. And it's so sad to me that while I was in Cuba this last time, it was a cab driver who told me, "Hey, did you hear they canceled that? They're going to stop running that on January 22nd. So I tell people, get that fare now. I saw it this morning online. It's a little more. It's $199 now. But you can go to Cuba for the next 6 weeks without the same runaround you're going to get after that, and without the same difficulty of getting a direct flight.
What do you make of what has been happening in Cuba of late and American relations with Cuba? President Trump is not at all disposed to maintain a relationship like what President Obama had envisioned, but there's also been the issue of the American diplomats and and American visitors to Cuba having strange sensations like they've been bombarded with sound or something.
I have to keep up on the news every day to learn more about that later part. But if you really look at it, and there's been a couple of good reports, both from the Times and the Post, you know, as both sides of the aisle, including one just last month that quoted an expert on audio injuries from Portland, who's a member of the American Academy of Physicians, et cetera, who said, we don't know of anything. We're the experts. We don't know of anything that could be ultrasonic warfare, and we think it's highly improbable. Then you back up a little and you realize if we had taken a slightly different approach and had a joint U.S.-Cuban investigation like the Cubans wanted, we might have gotten something. But everyone agrees now that the evidence is probably going to be hard to find. You only have the people who are complaining of having injuries and discomfort and their symptoms in order to look at it. Rewind 3 years, December 17th, 2014, when we were all surprised by the opening of relations that Obama announced in a televised news conference. That was a sense of hope. Cubans called it la apertura. It sounds much better in Spanish, the opening. And they were saying, we're finally going to get that opening. And as I learned back when I traveled in the winter, people still had hope, even though they were a little wary of what was going to happen with this new president. Then the announcement came in June that there was going to be a rollback of some of those open travel policies. And then finally, just 2 weeks ago, the replacement policy that's basically taking us back to where we were 30, 40 years ago. In fact, when the cab driver who told me about the canceled flights mentioned this, he said, you know what? We did this in 88, and here we are. We're going to have to do it again in 2018. And it's sad. He was putting his place on Airbnb and was looking forward to more people coming and actually having person-to-person cultural exchange. And you can still get there from here. That's my message for my friends and neighbors in the Rogue Valley. But it is going to be a little more complicated, and I worry that Cuba is still going to suffer more isolation like they have for the last 57 years.
And the Cuba of Havana Libre is a dark and isolated place. And so Manolo Rodriguez, what is he seeking out to do? What's his main driving force in the book?
He's really in somewhat of a funk at the beginning of the book. And I think the message and the experience for me writing this book, I didn't want to go to some of the dark places I have to go, but that's the nature of noir. And you find the light in the darkness. I think he gets a spark on meeting this young woman from the provinces, Mercedes, who he recognizes is not just her own life, but a new life that he wants to see go into the future. And when he realizes that he can do something to help her, he regains his faith in not just the Cuban medical system, but in humanitarianism and interpersonal, you know, just kindness. And so that itself becomes generative, especially when he realizes there are others who would try to hurt someone like this. And so that powerful dynamic of caring and then recognizing there are others who hate is, I think, what's motivating a lot of us to maintain hope these days.
So the central relationship is a fairly sweet platonic one, and yet you've got the sexy cover on the book of somebody barely draped behind the Havana Libre title. Is that just required for any noir book?
I wondered about that, and I look forward to more conversations about it. Let me say, first of all, although, you know, I encourage folks not to judge a book by its cover, it is an expressionist cover. And for me, when I saw this, which was one of several options that the publisher and one of my favorite designer, the blood. Thank you. That was what for me called out, wait a second. And just in the same way that a box of Cuban cigars, my favorite actually, called La Gloria Cubana, uses a female figure to represent Cuba or Havana, which both use the feminine article and are used, the female is used as a allegory for the city and the country, in Cuba especially, but in a lot of Latin American culture. When I saw this cover, I said, this is like Havana at risk. This is Havana in danger. And you'll still have the city intact. You'll still have beauty. You'll still have vulnerability. But I wanted to raise an alarm, perhaps even provide something of a trigger warning for my reader that this is a hard story to tell. But perhaps out the other side, there's a sense of of hope and of continuity in spite of adversity.
Havana Libre, just the latest work. You're also credited with the first interactive novel on the web, which I can imagine was probably a nightmare to provide all those different options for readers. You're the founding director of the Emerging Media and Digital Arts Center at Southern Oregon University. And then you got another book already in the works. So what or who is a freaky?
Ah, Los Frikis are a group of the most extreme kind of heavy metal and punk rockers in Cuba for the last 20, 25 years. They sort of emerged in the late 80s and were prominent across the island when I was traveling in the early 90s. They were targeted by the Castro government in the special period as counter-revolutionaries, just for their long hair, ripped jeans, and the music they listened to. And as many as 200 of them, according to the head of the National Medical Service in response to AIDS, took an extreme form of protest. They deliberately injected themselves with blood they knew to be HIV positive. It's a harsh thing to understand why and how they did this, which at the time was a slow, certain suicide. It was before the availability of antiretroviral drugs. Doctors didn't know what to do about AIDS. And that story, which actually back in 2014, the day of Obama's announcement of opening up relations with Cuba, the folks at Radiolab got in touch with me and produced a story around it that came out a few months later. If you look up Los Frikis, it's forming the heart of a book I'm working on and also a film that I'm helping filmmaker Neil Berkeley produce. We're going to try to understand Los Frikis and what led them to that, but also maybe what were some of the outcomes of the Cuban Revolution's attitude toward youth culture as a result.
Well, never a dull moment in the life and work of Robert Arellano. Like coffee on two legs.
That's right, Cuban coffee.
So the book is called Havana Libre. It's his latest novel, number 7 of his novels. He's also got nonfiction works. He'll be at Bloomsbury Books tonight on Ashland at 7 o'clock and back from sabbatical, I guess, in the winter quarter at Southern Oregon University. Bobby Arellano, always a pleasure.